Good grief. Question everything.
Welcome. You're listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt.
Welcome back to another episode of the Good Grief Network podcast.
And we're back.
We are back.
We've been on the road for 2 weeks and a lot has happened.
A lot.
I'm not even sure where to begin. Are you, Laura?
Well, let's just start with why we were on the road for two weeks. Why? Why were we traveling?
Well, so the first part of the journey was I went to Bear Lake for a Vision Fast. It's the same place that I did a Vision Fast 3 years ago. On the way to that Vision Fast, I was in a pretty serious car accident and have had major life changes since then. So I wanted to do the Vision Fast again, where I wasn't so shaken up from the accident. I wanted to go deeper into the experience. Laura came along and made sure I got there and was supported. And
sans accident this time.
Yes. That wasn't clear. Laura came along this time and helped me pack and feel supported. And I went out to have a deep and meaningful experience, and I did just that.
Well, let's take a step back. You said you were in an accident literally on your way to the Vision Fast.
I know. It's a story that seems a little unbelievable. In fact, sometimes I still have trouble believing it myself. But yes, I had a near-death experience on the way to my symbolic death, which is the Vision Fast.
Seems like there's something there.
I was the passenger in a vehicle. The driver was turning left out of a gas station. We had stopped at the gas station to ask directions because all of our directions were involving the lake. So, for example, turn right when you get to the lake or something very simple along that line. But with these wildfires going on, the smoke was so dense that we couldn't even see the lake. So we stopped at a gas station for directions. And as we were turning left out of this gas station, the driver didn't even see a truck pulling a trailer. It was a white truck, so it blended in with the smoke. And it was about noon when the police got there after the accident, and they said we were the fifth accident in this very small town. So what's been frustrating is Utah insurance requires you to have someone at fault, and technically the driver of my car is at fault, even though when you look at the circumstances, it could have happened to anybody.
It happened to five other people.
Yeah, and I mean, it was only noon, and we were the fifth accident, and I know they had another one later that night that involved the either the passenger or the driver being life flighted.
Wow.
So the fact that we even got up and walked away, three cars ended up being involved in the accident, and no one was seriously injured. And I guess technically I was, but I didn't know it right away.
So you wanted to do the Vision Fast again without all this weight, without all this backstory. So no accident this time.
No accident.
And so tell us about the experience of a Vision Fast.
So for a Vision Fast, it's basically the safest way to do the age-old ritual of fasting, which comes from a lot of different traditions. And the idea of fasting is that the hungrier your body gets, the weaker your ego gets. And so it's a way to commune with the divine or peace, light, you know, any
inner wisdom.
Your higher self, that sort of thing. And so you go out into the wilderness for 3 days and three nights by yourself, and you don't eat anything. And what is crazy about that is we forget that eating kind of provides structure to our day. And so when you have no meals or food to distract you, the time passes so slowly. So you go out there, you're not really supposed to take too many distractions. So I didn't really have books. I did have a journal. And you just sit in the wild for 3 days and three nights. And on the last night, you're supposed to stay up all night. It gets really cold. So I fell asleep a bit because I was in my sleeping bag. But you dance, sing, anything you need to do to stay awake. And The idea is you come away with some inner wisdom or clarity. And that being said, it's such a deep experience that they warn you it can take up to a year to fully process everything that happened in those 3 days.
Well, do you have any insights that you can share with our listeners just from your experience? I know you said it takes a year to sort of fully integrate this experience, but are there any takeaways that you can share?
Sure. I'm still processing. So yeah, I certainly don't have all the answers or anything along that line, but I got clarity from my last vision fast that I didn't have. In fact, it in some ways feels like I was in a 3-year-long vision fast, and that my first one and this last one kind of provided the bookmarks and the space for me to grow.
Grow in what ways?
To grow, mostly for me, it's about connecting with my higher self and trusting my body's wisdom. I sometimes am a little overly intellectual. It's been a downfall.
Oh, really?
Right. Who knew? I think too much. And so experiences like this remind me to go deeper into my body, to let go of some of that need to overanalyze, and really take in these experiences as an observer with no sort of agenda to make meaning. I try to let things be what they are rather than how I want them to be. And that's, of course, something I try to practice in my everyday life, but I think it goes to a whole nother level when you're in a deep form of other consciousness, such as fasting for 3 days.
Well, in this experience, you didn't do it alone, right? You had a couple guides and a cohort.
Yes, I did this in the safest way possible. It's based on the School of Lost Borders, and what they do is they create an 8-day retreat sort of style, and they cushion those 3 days, so you have a few days with other group members who are going out to do the same fast that you're doing. You have them to prepare, you slow down together, you have group meetings, if you will, and then after the fast, you'll have a day or two with these folks, too, where you can all try to process your experience together. And that being said, you also have two guides nearby at a base camp. They know where everybody is. You find your spot the day before the fast. You claim it as yours. You tell them. They mark it on a map. And then you have a buddy system where in the morning you set up something and in the evening your partner knocks it down or vice versa. If you go and your partner has not checked in, so to say, you go back to base camp and they know where the person should be on the map. They can send a search party. So it's basically the safest way to do this without seeing people, because you still are not going to actually see your partner because you agree one goes in the morning and one goes in the evening.
So literally, how did you spend your days? I mean, that's 3 full days being in the wilderness by yourself, no food to mark time. My guess is that you mark time with the sun?
Yes, and the moon. The sun and the moon are the closest thing to time that you have, and it turns into a dream. And so what did I do? I sat around a lot. And what was fascinating about that, though, is to watch how the birds and other animals like chipmunks responded to me. I watched them for all 3 days, and I'm still kind of mind blown by this, but between day 2 and day 3, by the time I woke up on the 3rd morning, the animals acted completely different around me. The first 2 days, they kind of avoided me. They treated me very much like a human. And by day 3, they didn't even seem concerned that I was there. And I would try to move slow so as not to startle them. But they honestly didn't care. And as the day progressed, I realized I could move. As long as I wasn't lunging directly at them, which of course I wasn't doing, I could do anything I wanted and they just let me be. And so I had a lot of meaningful interactions with woodpeckers especially, mountain bluebirds, an eagle, several hawks.
Coyotes?
The coyotes were incredibly vocal, and I felt, some people felt afraid, and I think in the past I've been afraid of coyotes, but this time I somehow felt connected to them, and it was actually really fun to listen to their sounds, because they're such vocal creatures.
I want to hear about your sleeping arrangements. Where did you sleep? How did you sleep? Did you sleep well? Was it uncomfortable? Were you scared?
You don't sleep well, and it does get a little scary I think I was more scared last time. This time
like
I...
the first time.
Yeah, yeah. I was okay. more scared on my last fast. And that was because I hadn't been out west a lot, and so I didn't know if coyotes were known to attack people. I didn't, and so you hear these animals really close to you, and you, if you don't know much about what they're going to do, it's pretty terrifying. Where this time I knew I didn't have much to worry about. That being said, what did get scary is you hear animals close to you, and you don't know what's close to you. And most of the time, they don't reveal themselves. At one point, I did get scared. I heard some creature close to me, and it sounded big, but also slow moving. And so it might have been something like a porcupine or who knows. But I heard a creature near me, and I got scared. And so I said verbally, "Who's there?" Just because you want to make your presence known. If you startle them, that's when they're likely to be afraid. And the creature just stopped moving and then went away on its own. And so chances are it was more scared of me than I was of it. I don't know what it was. But it is an interesting and terrifying feeling to know that something big and alive is moving near you. And I didn't have a tent. I set up a tarp between a few different trees. So I was at least had some shelter. And that being said, a tarp is not a tent, and so an animal can still totally trample over you if they want it. So it's a little scary. You're kind of putting your full trust out into the world to help take care of you.
What was your intention about going this time? Why did you go this year? You know, 3 years after your accident, you've already done a vision fest once. We're living in Nebraska and not Utah anymore. So what was the pull to do this kind of work this year, this season, this time in your life?
I felt a lot stronger than I was last time. Between my yoga teacher training, having to live with chronic pain from my car accident, and then getting treatment finally for it, and being reminded that when my body is not in extreme pain, all that it can do. I also didn't have my own gear. I had barely had much experience outdoors when I went on my first vision fast. I borrowed everything. This time I had my own backpack, my own camping gear, and I felt prepared. And I packed a lot less for my solo fast, which was actually quite liberating, because when you're packing, you're kind of afraid. And the shamanic practitioner said, keep in mind you're packing for safety rather than comfort. And that gave me permission not to pack half of the things I had planned.
Okay, and I am interested to hear what the first thing is that you ate after your fast. When you come back to base camp, what did you eat?
Well, your stomach's a little bit sensitive from not eating for 3 days and three nights, and so we kept it pretty simple with things like avocado and egg and crackers.
Isn't that what you eat all the time anyway?
That is pretty much my power for food, because it's cheap and easy, and I don't like to cook, and it's good fuel for my body. So yeah, it was just what I wanted and needed, and it was delicious.
Awesome, awesome.
I guess I would also just like to point out that I had an incredible group and incredible guides for my vision fast, and that makes a huge difference. I met some phenomenal people who say yes to a vision fast are not generally your everyday average person. They usually have something big going on in their life, or they're looking for some deeper meaning in their life. And so to have three other people doing this fast, coming from different places and backgrounds, and watch them push their body to the limits on the fast as well, was an honor. And I'm still processing the gifts from that. And the guides, Kindi, Nebaker, and Karen. Turns out I don't know Karen's last name.
Just Karen.
So Kindi and Karen both held space for us while we were fasting, and they're powerhouses, and I feel lucky to have spent a week with them as well as my fellow fasters.
Well, and we can connect in the show notes information about Kindi's work, because both Amy and I have done tremendous work with Kindi, and we love her. She is a fantastic human being. We call her our spiritual mentor for a number of reasons, but if you are seeking any sort of work that Kindi offers, things like medicine walks and rites of passage work, Kindi is the person to go to, for sure.
Yeah, and as for the questions earlier about the specifics and things, there's a lot that happened that I'm still processing, and some of the stories, what would you describe them? I mean, they're hard to believe. Some of the stories are hard to believe, and I think that only means that they're meant for me to use as internal tools and not share as external tools.
Yeah, well, you mentioned you sort of get into this dream state, right? Where everything sort of feels not real. You know, you're not in your normal life. You're not in your normal routine. You're out in the middle of the wilderness for an extended period of time. So it makes sense that your experiences, you know, you need time and space to integrate them and share publicly what you end up wanting to share, right? Maybe when you're this raw, you need to figure out a way to integrate it first and then share it.
Yes. So I guess what I am willing to talk about is that the fast becomes like poetry. And what I love about poetry compared to creative nonfiction is we don't sit around and say, did this really happen like this? Is this true for every detail in the poem? Because the poem becomes something on its own where it speaks to a deeper truth. And at that point, it doesn't really matter if that's exactly what the person said or if that's how it made the poet feel. And so with the Vision Fast, I did take some pictures to prove to myself that some things literally happened and were concretely true. But beyond that, it doesn't really matter if it's real or not, because you've entered an agreement to be in this other consciousness that's dreamlike. And so rather than sit there and try to figure out the logistics of how this egg wound up in this special place, rather than sit there and analyze that and say, well, how could this happen? It's a mystery. I can look deeper and say, well, what does this mean? Rather than how did it happen? How do I prove that it happened? I think that's the key part is also on the Vision Fast. I'm not coming from a place of having something to prove. It's not about what can I tell others when I come back. It's about experiences that validate my own personal internal experience, which then gives me the power in the future to use my discrepancy about what to talk about publicly and what not to. Because I think when you're talking about spiritual experiences, there will be certain things that transcend language, and trying to put language to it so that others can understand it just becomes taxing. And it becomes taxing, and I think it defeats the purpose of the experience. I think it belittles the experience if we try to prove something from it or translate it. I think at a certain point, it's about accepting impermanence, including your own, and that these are living stories that I got to experience and that I can try to pass on if it feels right, but that they're never going to be the same for someone else as me directly experiencing it.
My next question for you is, how does an experience like this inform your work with Good Grief?
For me, it's about confidence. I have been a pretty timid person when it comes to what others will think of me. In fact, one of my regrets from high school is being too nice and not standing up for things as much as I would do now. And that came from a place of fear. Fear of what people will think, but also fear of hurting people. I didn't ever want to hurt anybody. I was afraid to hurt people. I felt a lot of hurt. I felt things big. And so I just tried to make everyone around me comfortable all the time. And while there's some nobility to that and altruism to that that I believe was genuine, I also believe that it does others a disservice. Basically, in the past, I've been timid to speak out, especially if I know it's going to upset someone. Where these experiences on the Vision Fast give me confidence in my heart power and my heart's ability to distinguish truth. And I no longer want to be small. To make people feel comfortable, especially people who are, what would you say, like getting in the way of truth, or people who are not living with truth as their moral compass and have other motives. And so I'm feeling a little more fiery. I'm feeling more confident in this heart and gut that I used to ignore, and that I can combine my heart and my gut with my brain power. And when I use them together, I recognize truth. I might not be able to speak truth all the time, and I might not be able to live truth all the time, but I know how to recognize it. And now that I know how to recognize it, I have such confidence in that truth that I think I'm going to be a lot more fearless in certain avenues. That doesn't mean I'm not going to have anxiety. P.S.
Well, my next question for you, Amy, is should everyone do a Vision Fast?
I used to think yes. I think after this last time, that has changed. Mostly because I got to listen to two of the other fasters talk about how people they know could never do it. And that doesn't make those people lesser than. it just isn't something that they have a desire to do. They would be, it's very physically uncomfortable. Some people are not good at being uncomfortable. And that it's a certain kind of person with a need for something deeper that is drawn to an experience like this. I want to say yes, because I want to believe everyone can have these deeper experiences. But it does take a certain level of, I was going to say strength, but I don't know if that's the word I want. But it takes a certain level of determination.
Well, and courage, which is a form of strength, right? And discipline.
And really, I think we come to these experiences because we have something to prove. For me, it was to prove to myself. I guess I can't speak for the other fasters if they had something to prove or what they were trying to get. But some people are content with not having something to prove. And therefore, why would they put themselves through this experience? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know who wants to go on a fast and why.
So the fast seems like a tool or a gateway.
Yes.
And there are many tools and gateways that people can use, especially if they're seeking. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, cool. Are there any other insights that you would like to share?
Watch out, because I'm strong now.
Are you going to say that with a more confident voice? You're going to say it with a little meek voice, you just said it.
Well, it feels foreign to be confident. And I'm not. What's interesting is I've come back and I have less confidence in certain areas. And it has to do with maintaining the status quo and money and all of that stuff. But I have more confidence in my gut now more than ever. And so watch out if my gut is telling me
to go kill someone.
Why'd you have to take it there?
If you're telling people to watch out.
Watch out if you're trying to tell me that something's not true. I'm not going to be bullied into submission is this new confidence that I'm feeling. So you can come at me. Come at me, bro. So I guess watch out. Like, I'm going to be a force to reckon with. And that has not been a confidence I've had in the past.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to witness. So,
thank you.
Yeah. And thanks for sharing that story.
Thank you.
A vision fast is certainly not for everyone. I would agree with your answer to that. You know, it takes a specific kind of person searching for a specific kind of thing, you know, whatever someone's looking for. It just becomes this. Why are you laughing?
I'm sorry, because it becomes a specific kind of thing. Like, we're using such vague words, but it's because how do you explain or describe a vision fast? When I'm not the one speaking, I can go back into that, like, critical headspace again and, like, oh, this thing.
Yeah.
It's this thing.
Well, because you're searching for something, and maybe you don't know. Maybe your gut just tells you take a chance and experiment with this, you know? If you have the resources to be able to go on something like this and your gut tells you it's a good idea and that maybe you can glean some insight from it, do it. Do it. Just do it. Just try something that's hard. You can do hard things. We can do hard things. And a lot of us are afraid to do hard things. And I don't know. It just seems like that's a theme that keeps coming back in my life, is encouraging people that we all can do hard things. My sister, she coaches cross country, which is a hard sport. It's a difficult thing to do, you know, to push yourself to run a 5K. And then not only just run the 5K, because some days the races are the easiest part of running cross country. It's the training and it's the miles and it's the attitude to continue to push yourself even when you think you've hit that wall. Push yourself past this wall. And that's the same thing that you do on a vision fast. You know, it's the same thing you do when you're trying to be open to feeling your feelings. And I guess my main message today and for this episode is that we can all do hard things, you know, and hard things look different for everybody. But what are you scared of, and what's preventing you from really wanting to do the things that you want to do or be the person you want to be? Just try to do a hard thing. There's a quote that says, do one thing every day that scares you. And I kind of try to live in that philosophy and that mindset. You and I go on a lot of adventures and, you know, we've been able to do a lot of cool things, but it's because we're not afraid to try to put ourselves out there, and we're not afraid to try to push forward and see what else happens if we do this other thing. And I think that a lot of people get stuck. So again, my message for the day, we can do hard things. We can push ourselves. We can do scary things. And not only can we, but we need to, especially in times like these, when we're seeing a lot of collapse of a lot of systems that we've depended on. That's scary. And that shuts a lot of people down. And mine and Amy's message is to not let our fear overcome who we want to be and the best versions of ourselves and who we want to present ourselves as, and also the work we want to do in the world. We have to keep doing hard things in order to make ourselves better, in order to make the world better.
Which reminds me of yang holds in yoga. A lot of people are familiar with yin yoga, where you're holding these longer, you're holding poses for longer periods of time to get a deeper stretch. Yang holds are something similar to, I don't know, are they plyometrics? Or I don't know the technical term for training poses, such as squats, where you hold them for a very long time. But the idea of yang holds is you're going to fail. We pick a time in yoga to time it so that it is physically impossible for even the fittest person to stay in this pose. What this means is you're forced to find your edge, you're forced to confront your body's limitations, and yet you are forced to distinguish the difference between wanting to come out of the pose because it's uncomfortable and needing to come out of the pose because your body needs a rest. And what blew my mind about this, and I should confess that I actually hated yang holds, and I still do sometimes. They're not fun. They're mentally challenging. And yet I love the results I was seeing in my personal life from being able to find that edge. You could try these yang holds. Try doing a squat for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, something that you know you're going to fail, and just keep getting back in the pose. And the more you practice, you're going to start to tell the difference of when it's mental and when it's physical that you need to come out. And you're going to start to learn how to push beyond your mental capacity, and you're going to be able to hold it longer. And eventually your body gets physically stronger to match that.
So the word that comes to me right now, too, is discipline. What you're talking about sounds a lot like we're teaching our minds discipline by doing hard things. You know, first you do the hard thing. You gain confidence, you know, you prove to yourself that fear can be conquered, and then that forms a sort of discipline.
Yes, and I also would argue it helps differentiate between discipline for discipline's sake and actual discipline in finding your edge. And what I mean by that is I know the overachievers, I've been the overachiever, who is going to push beyond your limits time and time again, which will lead to injury, so it's not even in your best interest to do this. I think there's also a place for the fuck it, let's have a beer. There's a place for that too. And it's about knowing, if your default is every time, fuck it, let's have a beer, and you don't want to do hard things, you should probably look at yourself. But if you're someone who pushes through at all costs, I also am suspicious that that's not coming from the right heart space and that is coming from some need to prove something. I don't want to come from a place of needing to prove anything anymore.
So it sounds like balance.
That's
the answer to everything.
I was going to say that is literally the answer to everything.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to balance, you're talking about self-awareness and intention. Like, what is your intention in doing hard things? Is it to prove to everybody else that you can do hard things, or is it to build your confidence and prove to yourself that you can do hard things?
Well, and at what point are we willing to cut ourselves a break without shame? Because I've noticed this with working the rock wall. Sometimes people need to come down. They need that break, and they'll say, I'm falling, which is the command you give to let the belayer know you're going to come down. And sometimes the belayer will say, no, just take a break where you're at and climb on. And that can be really powerful. But other times you can tell the person is emotionally riled up in a way where they need to come back on the ground and take a few deep breaths before they try it again. And so what I'm trying to learn is how to recognize the difference in others as part of my job, but also I want to always know the difference in myself. And it might be impossible to always know, and I guess that's where we can count on loved ones who hopefully know us well to help push us when we need a little push and help remind us to be gentle with ourselves when we need a bit of that. Thanks for listening to my experiences on the Vision Fast. I'm excited to share our experiences from the Uplift Climate Conference in New Mexico on next week's episode, so stay tuned.
All right, I think this is a wrap for this episode. A lot of insight coming to you from Amy and her journey on the Vision Fast. I wanted to take a moment and thank our patrons and all the people who support us continuously. We literally couldn't be doing what we're doing without you. We are nearly 100% supporter funded at this time. We mentioned we work at the Y for a couple hours a week, but that certainly doesn't pay nearly any of our bills. But yeah, so we really put our trust and our faith in you folks. And, you know, if you like what you hear, consider becoming a patron. If you want to help support us and encourage us in other ways, we do have an Amazon wish list full of books that we would love to dig into. We just can't afford all of them right now. And so that's another way that you can contribute to us. And then the other way to contribute is just send an email, send a message, tell us, you know, what you like, what you don't like, what we can improve on. Tell us where you're at. Where are you coming from? What kind of work are you doing in the world? And how might we be able to collaborate? So that's where we're at now. We are full of gratitude for the Meyer family, for our patrons again, and just for everybody who takes a second to tell us what we're doing impacts them. That means a lot. So thank you.
And it's why we do what we do.
Thank you for listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with your hosts, Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt. If you like what you hear, consider subscribing, commenting, leaving feedback, or just checking out our Patreon page. We'll come back at you next week with some more information and some more big questions. Thank you for listening.